If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I think it just challenges the idea that Tudors were all white, as you say, that is portrayed in films and novels and things like that. And I think it also challenges the Windrush myth that Africans only appeared here in the middle of the 20th century. And it shows that England had a much more diverse history over the centuries than we expect.
That was Miranda Kaufman discussing the lives of black people in Tudor England.
Listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. In today's episode, you'll hear from Dr. Miranda Kaufman, who's a historian based at the University of London. She's the author of a new book entitled Black Tudors, which explores the lives of a number of Africans who made England their home in the 16th century. Miranda was one of the speakers at our History Weekend event in York a few days ago, and after her talk, she spoke to our website assistant, Rachel Dinning.
I thought we could start with quite a general question. So there's this popular idea that black people or people of African origin first arrived in England in 1948. So when the Windrush docked at Tilbury, you mentioned this in the opening introduction to your book. Why do you think that this preconception exists? And why don't we know much about the people who came to England in, for example, the Tudor period? Why is it a hidden part of history?
Well, I think the Windrush, there's a lot of video footage and photographs, and so it's all quite, and it's relatively recent, so people know that story. But with the Black Tudors, the records are much more hard to get hold of, and there's not so many pictures, that's for sure. And so I think it's, you know, I think, as I said in the book, you know, people haven't asked those questions of the past. They didn't think to ask, well, were there any Africans in Tudor England? It just wasn't something that people have thought about in the past. But, you know, now scholars are beginning to ask those questions, and that's why we're finding out what these things that we didn't previously know.
And what drew you to this area? Like, what made you write this book?
Well, I just got curious about it, really, because I was, you know, it's been a long gestation, this project. It started as when I was doing my master's and doctorate at Oxford. And it all started when I heard in a lecture that that the Tudors had started trading to Africa in the middle of the 16th century, which is something I didn't know. And I thought that was interesting, and I wanted to know more about that encounter, what the Tudor sailors thought of the Africans and what the Africans thought of the Tudor sailors. And I started reading around that, and that's when I found this reference saying there had actually been Africans in Tudor England, which was a big surprise, and I just wanted to know more about it, but there didn't seem to be that much written about it, so that's when I had to go start searching in the archives for myself.
So in terms of like the evidence that you've looked at, how did you go about finding these people?
Well, I got in touch with an organisation called the Black and Asian Studies Association, and that one of their members had written a short piece for History Today magazine about Black Tudors, and so I got in touch with her, and she shared, you know, what she'd found out with me, and then I built on that. So, for example, she knew of a couple of parish registers that had Africans in them, but she'd only seen one entry. But if I went back, to those parish registers and read through them in more detail and found more information like that.
So I know that we don't look at the demographics of Tudor England in your book. That's not what it's about. It's about the individuals. But what sort of numbers are we looking at?
Well, I found about 200 Africans in Tudor England. But I was also looking at a longer period for my doctorate, so up to 1640. And in that period, I found 360-odd Africans. There could be more, but that's how many I found.
It sounds maybe a stupid question, but how do you know that they were black? Yeah.
Well, they're described. I only chose ones that were actually described as African rather than just having a strange surname or something. You can't assume everyone with the surname Black or Moore was African. But they're described. The most popular term was Blackamoor. So it'll say something like John, a Blackamoor, was buried on this day or whatever. But there are other. Some of them are called Negars or Negar or Ethiop or Moor, and you know, so they're described like that. So that's how you know that.
Okay, so it would be wrong to go purely off a surname. You can't assume someone's race through their surname.
I don't think so.
No. So people who learn about the presence of Africans in Tudor England might assume that their experience was one of enslavement or racial discrimination. But this isn't true, according to what you've written in your book. So what can you tell us about the status of the people that you've been looking at? How do they fit in society?
Well, they're free in the eyes of the law. There's no law of slavery in England, so they're not enslaved. A lot of them were working as domestic servants, but are doing, real work within those households. There's a porter, there's a laundry maid, there's a cook, a gardener. You know, so they're doing real jobs within those households. They're not decorative playthings, or that's something that I think comes later. And some of them were self-employed, so have independent tradespeople like Reasonable Blackman the silk weaver. There's a needle maker in 1540s Cheapside. There's Catalina of Almondsbury, who owns a cow. They're doing a few different things. There are people just visiting, like Prince Dederidge Akawa, who's just staying in London for a couple of years learning English, and then he goes back to Africa. So there's quite a range of people.
And the attitude at the time, what would the Tudor people make of Africans in England? Did they have the same idea about race as what came later? Or would there be racism, or would they be preoccupied with other forms of prejudice?
Yeah, like I say in the book, I think that the prejudices that existed were much more based around class and religion. So, you know, an ambassador is going to be treated differently to someone who's just come off a captured Spanish ship. And, you know, religiously as well, if you weren't a Protestant, then you were, you know, penalised and treated worse than if you were. I didn't find any explicit evidence of extreme racism, really. I mean, I think racism as a concept is something that probably, you know, work evolves later.
So what evidence is there for how Africans were sort of treated in England's churches and courts? You spoke a bit about the legal system in your talks.
Yeah, they were allowed to testify in court, which is a big deal because slaves aren't allowed to testify in court. So if the fact that they are allowed to shows that they were considered free in the eyes of the law, their testimony is given equal weight to other people's testimonies, which is significant. And the way that they're accepted by the church in baptism, marriage and burial sort of shows a sort of a different level of acceptance into Tudor society as well, because it was such a religious society that allowing them to be baptized was a big deal.
So some historians argue that sort of what happened in colonial America with sort of chattel slavery was perhaps linked to 16th century England and the sort of the attitudes there. But what would your response to that be?
I think that what was happening in colonial America is just quite different to what happened in England. And so I think historians need to look again at that early history of Virginia and the early colonies to sort of question why they developed the way they did. And I think it's more to do with like the economic imperative to the new crops that they were working with in the New World required slave labour, whereas that wasn't the case in England.
You talk a bit in the book about people coming onto English shores and could be free there. Was that true? Could a slave come to England and be free?
That was certainly what was said at the time, that if you set foot on English soil, you became free.
Is there any evidence that that actually happened? Did anyone come over?
There's a guy called Pero Alvarez who tells the King of Portugal that he was set free by King Henry VII of England, and the King of Portugal accepts that status. And then there's another man called Diogo who comes to England in 1614 with an English pirate. And he, again, reports back to the Portuguese Inquisition later that he was set free, that he became free in England, because in that reign, nobody is a slave, he said.
So let's talk specifically about the people in your book. How and why did they come to England? Do we know, like, some of their motives? Was it just circumstantial? Like, maybe give some examples.
I don't think many Africans came to England completely of their own free will. I think that there were three main ways in which they came here. Some came directly from Africa as a result of the trade between England and Africa that was developing at this period, like Dedere Jakawa. And it's not entirely clear whether he wanted to come to England or not, but there are reasons why he might have done, because his kingdom was beginning to trade with the English. So coming to England, he could learn English, which would be useful for trading. He could find out more about the markets here and what would sell and what his goods would be like in that marketplace. And so the baptism record for him says that his father had sent him to England to be baptized. So that's quite interesting. But we know that he did go home and that he did start working as a trade factor when English merchants showed up. So that's quite interesting. The second way that Africans came here was via Southern Europe. So there were a lot more Africans in Spain, Portugal and some in Italy than there were in England. So for example, when Catherine of Aragon comes to England in 1501, we think John Blanc was in her entourage. Other Africans come with European merchants, and like some of the Portuguese Jewish merchants in London had Africans in their households. And the third way is through privateering. So when Francis Drake was raiding the Caribbean or capturing Spanish ships, other privateers as well, if they're capturing Spanish ships, then there's quite often Africans on board the ships, or certainly in Spanish ports, and they get brought back that way as well.
So you look at 10 individuals in total, and your book's, it's sort of like an anthology of miniature biographies of these different people. So one person that I found really interesting was Jack Francis, who was one of the divers, actually, who went down and excavated Mary Rose. So, yeah, would you like to tell me a bit about this man, Jack?
Well, he says he's born on an island off the coast of Guinea in the 1520s. We know that by the time he was 18, he was working in Southampton for this Venetian called Peter Paolo Corsi, and they're diving to try and salvage guns from the Mary Rose. But then they get accused of stealing tin from the wreck of another ship called the Sancta Maria and Sancta Sedwardas. And that gets them into court, and that's where we find out more about him, is in the court records. And he's a witness in the case, and he gives testimony in support of his master. So we know that he would have been a skilled diver.
Well, I'm really curious about this. So diving in the 16th century, like, what would that look like? Would he just swim? Would there be any equipment that he wore to, like, you know, we have today, we'd have scuba diving, but back then, how would he dive down to this ship?
Well, there's this skill that still does happen today called free diving, which is diving without equipment. And if you have to start quite young, I think, but if you you can, you know, train yourself to breathe and to equalise the pressure in your ears and do things that, you know, mean that you can dive without equipment. But there is some equipment that that would have been available to them to use at the time. So maybe a form of diving bell, which is a bell that you submerge under the water, and then it holds a pocket of air in it, so you can swim under there and breathe a bit more and then go out again. Or they had, they would tie stones to rope and put them over their shoulders to weigh them down to get them to the ocean floor.
So what was the verdict? What happened with the court case?
We don't know, because the verdict doesn't survive, unfortunately.
Oh, no. Okay. So we don't know what happened to him.
Well, we don't know what happened to Jack Francis. We know that Corsi gets imprisoned in the Tower of London a few months later, but not because of the result of the court case, but because he's gone off to do some salvage work for the Earl of Arundel, whereas, he was still meant to be doing the Mary Rose, so... The king gets cross with him and throws him in the tower.
Let's talk about the man in chapter 5. His name was Reasonable Black Man, which is an incredible name. I know you mentioned that names aren't necessarily a good signifier of a person, but his name just seems so particularly interesting. Does it tell us anything about him?
Well, maybe he was very reasonable in his... Yeah, I feel like it sounds like a kind of trading name almost to reflect his reasonable prices, perhaps, when he's weaving silk for you. I don't know, but it could be some kind of nickname. I mean, you know, they did have nicknames like that in the Tudor period, so...
Okay, he was a silk weaver. Would you like to tell me about his life?
Unfortunately, we don't really know that much about him, except that he was living in Southwark in the Elizabethan period from about 1579, probably, and that he had a family there. We don't know anything about his wife, but he was married because the records are actually the records of the baptism and burials of his children. So the fact that they're not described as bastard children means that the parents must have been married. And unfortunately, two of them die in the plague in 1592, I think. They die of the plague, and that's quite sad. But that's the last we hear of the family, really.
Was his wife also was she black?
Well, we don't really know. But just given the relatively few small numbers of Africans in Tudor London, I think it's more likely that she was English.
I think a misconception that people might have is that people coming over from Africa would have been servants and very, in the low levels, but some of them moved in sort of the higher echelons of society. So, for example, John Blank in the opening chapter, he was a musician in the court of Henry VIII.
John Blank played the trumpet for Henry VII and Henry VIII. We don't know where he came from exactly or quite how he got here. We think that he probably came with Catherine of Aragon when she came to England to marry Prince Arthur in 1501. But there's no direct evidence for that. We know he played at the coronation of Henry VIII and the funeral of Henry VII, not in that order. And he was paid wages. He was paid 8 pence a day under Henry VII. And then when Henry VIII comes to the throne, he asks for a wage increase. and it's granted. So then he's paid 16 pence a day. We know he goes on to play in the Westminster tournament, which was a big jousting tournament that Henry VIII commissioned to celebrate the birth of a son to him and Catherine of Aragon, who was unfortunately very short-lived. But they had this big jousting tournament, and it was depicted in the Westminster tournament roll. This was in 1511, and it's that which the roll is a sort of 6-foot-long manuscript in vellum, painting all the knights, you know, riding to the joust and the jousting scene in the middle, and then everyone processing away from it as well. And John Blank's depicted twice in that Westminster roll.
Oh wow!
Playing the trumpet.
Is he the only black man in this scroll then? In the pictures. So let's talk about some of the women in your book. Anne Cobby's quite an interesting one. So she worked in a brothel in the 1620s. What do we know about her?
Well, we know she was working in this brothel belonging to John and Jane Banks in St Clement's Danes in Westminster. And she appears in the court case when the Bankses are brought to court for keeping a brothel, which was illegal, before the Westminster Sessions Court. And one of the other prostitutes talks about her, and court says, you know, that she calls her a tawny Moor, which means she has relatively fair skin. So that could mean she came from somewhere in North Africa, or possibly I'm thinking that maybe she could have been the child of an African and an English person, perhaps. She's a tawny Moor, and according to the other woman, men were willing to pay, you know, much more to lie with her than they would another woman because of her soft skin.
Working as a prostitute in London, was she earning quite a lot of money? Was she, you know, was she making a success of this, or was it sort of a struggle? Do we know what being a prostitute in London at this time was like?
Well, you get the impression, I mean, insofar as you can tell, that she's doing quite well, but, you know, because she's working in the brothel, she has to give possibly half her pay to the board, to Mrs. Banks, possibly. Mm-hmm. I think they say they give a... It says in the record that the men would give a piece to lie with her, and I think a piece was 22 shillings, which is quite a substantial amount compared with what other people were earning at the time, I think. It all depends how many customers she had, I suppose.
Yeah, true. Were there other black prostitutes in England at this time? Did we have any record of them, or was she unusual?
I think she is quite unusual. I didn't find much more evidence in this period. People have looked through the Bridewell records, which are quite a key source for prostitutes at the time, but there's more evidence of African men visiting English prostitutes than the other way around.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway. and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
I think I've touched on this a little bit. So we know that Anne Cobby had sex with white men, obviously outside of marriage as a prostitute, but do we know if there were interracial relationships and were they accepted at this time? Would there have been the outrage that there might have been later on?
Yeah, so there are records of marriages in the parish registers between African people and English people. There's a few more with African men marrying English women, but there is at least one example of an African woman marrying an English man, and that's in Bristol in the early 17th century, about 1603, I think.
And like you said before, people were more concerned with class and religion, so I presume if like they were of the same class and religion, then it'd probably have been accepted. Or is that something we can't possibly know?
I think, yeah, it's difficult to know, but I didn't find any explicit evidence of people being hostile to those relationships. I think there may have been more curiosity. There's a quote from a man called George Best in 1578 who says, you know, he's seen an Ethiopian as black as coal taking a fair English woman to wife and begetting a son as black as the father. So there's that curiosity about the products of those relationships and, you know, skin colour and how that's transmitted through the generations. But I don't think it's a hostile feeling.
There's another moment in the book where there's a baptism of I think it's a black woman, and it says in the records that quite a lot of people went to it, and I think you sort of ponder on whether this was because it was sort of, you know, it was people were curious, it was something they'd never seen before.
Yeah, that was the baptism of Mary Phyllis of Morisco in 1597.
Okay.
St. Botolph's Aldgate. So that's, she's one of the other chapters.
Yeah, tell me about her.
Well, she came to England from Morocco when she was about 6 or 7 in 1583 or 4, and she goes to work for John Barker, a merchant. So it's possible that he was trading to Morocco, especially because he had a relationship with the Earl of Leicester, who was head of the governor of the Barbary Company, who were set up to trade to Morocco. So it's possible that that's how she got here. And then she switches jobs. She goes to work for a seamstress in East Smithfield called Millicent Porter. And so possibly she learnt the art of being a seamstress as well. And then she gets, you know, Millicent Porter seems to encourage her to get baptised. And she, I think when she's 20 years old, she gets baptised at St. Botolph's Aldgate.
Oh, I was actually going to ask, because you mentioned the Earl of Leicester and sort of the trading. What was the sort of situation at the time with England's ties with Africa? What sort of extent was, like, trading going on? And, you know, what were the links between England and Africa at this time?
Well, the strongest trade was with Morocco, which starts in 1551. And by 1558, there's a regular trade with Morocco, with English factors resident in Morocco, in Moroccan ports. And yeah, apparently before the 1620s, there are actually more English people living in North Africa than in North America, which is a, you know, fact that I always thought was amazing. And then there is a bit more of an exploratory trade with what they call Guinea, which is sort of more like the west coast of Africa. And you know, by the sort of towards the end of the 16th century, they are beginning to get as far as the Cape of Good Hope and South Africa. So they're sort of slowly making their way down the west coast of Africa. But those voyages are a bit more unstructured, not sort of regular.
Okay.
But then the East India Company starts trading in, towards the end of this period as well, and they stop off on the coast of Africa.
So quite a general question. Which story in the book, which person is most interesting to you? Which, if you had to pick a favourite?
I quite enjoyed writing about Dedewi Jakawa and the like learning about the that early trade with Africa and the different commodities, and you know, imagining him coming to London, and that I think that was quite interesting. But it was all good.
Yeah. Obviously, all of them were interesting to you. Were there any actually stories that you set out to include but had to disregard, or like how did you go about choosing these people?
I mean, I chose them because they were the ones we knew most about, you know, from the source records. There were a couple of chapters that got cut, but I tried to incorporate them into the book in other places, like Maria, the African woman who gets abandoned heavily pregnant on an island in Indonesia by Francis Drake. Originally had her own chapter, but because she'd never actually set foot on English soil, we decided that she didn't really count as a Black Tudor.
Okay, that makes sense.
But she gets incorporated into the chapter on Diego. I enjoyed writing the chapter on Diego as well. That was a good one.
Yeah, tell me about him.
Diego joined... Francis Drake was raiding Nombre de Dios in Panama in 1572, and Diego runs up to some of his ships and says, you know, demands to be taken on board even though they're shooting at him. And he gets on board and he warns the English that they're, you know, in danger, that the Spaniards are going to come and get them in Nombre de Dios. And he gets onto the English ships and helps them connect with the Cimarroons, who were Africans who'd escaped from the Spanish and had their own settlements in the hinterland. And together, the English and the Maroons attack the Spanish mule train carrying silver across the Isthmus of Panama and make their fortune. So that's how they first met. But then Diego goes on to sail with Drake on his circumnavigation voyage in 1577-80. But then he, unfortunately, he dies along the way from an arrow wound, because they land on an island off the coast of Chile called Mocha Island, and get attacked by the inhabitants, and Diego sustains an arrow wound, but it doesn't actually kill him for another year, so it's possible that he becomes gangrenous later on or something. So yeah, it's not quite clear, but he seems to have lived until they got as far as the Moluccas.
Chapter 4 of your book, you look at this man called Edward Swarthy, who actually whipped a high-ranking white servant on behalf of a man called Sir Edward Winter. This is really fascinating because it sort of breaks down these stereotypical constructs that people might imagine of a white man whipping a black man, for example, and this flips that on its head. So tell me about the circumstances of this incident.
So it was punishment, really, for John Guy, because he'd really angered his master, Sir Edward Winter. And there's differing accounts as to why he was so angry, but John Guy was in control of Edward Winter's ironworks, which was a substantial part of his property. And one summer when Edward Winter was away on business in London, John Guy runs off to Ireland with two of the other two ironworkers. It's not entirely clear why, but Edward Winter finds out and he's really angry that he left the ironworks unmanaged at home. But Edward Winter's got an ongoing feud with his neighbour, James Buck. And James Buck thinks that that Winter's particularly angry with Guy because Guy has just married Anne Buck, who is James Buck's daughter, which is a sort of big sign of disloyalty from John Guy. There's a sort of day of reckoning when Edward Winter, you know, calls John Guy to see him in his great hall at Whitecross Manor in front of a crowd of sort of 20 men or so, and berates him for everything that he's done, and then orders Edward Swarthy to whip him.
And what view is the significance of this? Like, why did you particularly want to include this in the book? What do you think it tells us?
Well, I think it just inverts the stereotype. And I mean, when I first found the record of this, I couldn't immediately read the document. And the one word that jumped out at me was whip. And I just assumed that it was going to be the African being whipped by an Englishman. But it turned out to be the other way around. And that really, you know, says a lot, I think, about what was going on in this period. That it wasn't, there just wasn't the relationship between black and white that developed later.
Mm-hmm. What was Edward Swarthy's relationship with Edward Winter. I mean, they share the same name, the first name, but what was their relationship?
Well, I think that means that Edward Winter might well have been Edward Swarthy's godfather as well as his master, because that was quite a common occurrence that when Africans were baptised in England, they were baptised with the name of the godfather. When Dedria Jokawa, the prince of River Sestos, is baptised, he's called John, which is the name of the merchant he was staying with in England as well. So I think that's their relation. And then Edward Swarthy is working for Edward Winter as a porter, which was, it's the person who stayed at the gate of the manor and allowed people in or turned them away at the gate.
The stories of these Tudors, why hasn't there been more research into this area, do you think?
I think, as we talked about this a bit in the beginning, I just think we hadn't asked those questions before, and the records aren't that easy to find because there's not like a special archive just dedicated to Black Tudors. Or, when you go to an archive, it's usually organised in terms of people's surnames or dates, and that doesn't make it very easy to find this sort of material. But, hopefully there'll be more research done on it in the future.
Do you think part of it is because we have this idea of the Tudor period being just white and, you see it in the television shows and the books that we have, you just think of white people and that's what you see, and so that's what people sort of think was the case, and so yeah. These people get maybe forgotten or skimmed over if there is a mention of them in research.
Yeah, I think, although it's slowly changing now, I just saw Gunpowder, which is early Stuart, but there were a couple of black actors in that in the background, which was good to see. I hope there'll be more like that.
To sort of sum up, why is it important to tell these stories?
Well, I think it just challenges the idea that Tudors were all white, as you say, that is portrayed in films and novels and things like that. I think it also challenges the Windrush myth that the Africans only appeared here in the middle of the 20th century. And it shows that England had a much more diverse history over the centuries than we expect.
That was Miranda Kaufman. Black Tudors, The Untold Story is out now in the UK and the US, published by One World. And you can read a piece by Miranda in the December issue of BBC History magazine, which is currently on sale, with Elizabeth I and Lettice Knowles on the cover. Well, that's about it for today, but please do join us again on Monday, when we'll be talking to Simon Heffer about Britain at the turn of the 20th century.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.